All right, morning, everybody. Happy Easter. How are you? If you're hopping in for the first time, or just the first time in a while, today we are actually in the 16th and the final week of our series out of Luke's Gospel that we're calling At the Table with Jesus. So before I get to the text we're going to be in this morning, let me just kind of give you an idea of what the heart of this series was, start to finish. If you were to sit down and spend really any length of time in Luke's Gospel, two things I think would very quickly become apparent to you. The first is that of all the ways that Jesus could have spent his time here, and he only had about 3.5 years to change the world, that's all the time he gave himself, Luke makes it more clear than any other gospel writer that Jesus spent a seemingly inordinate amount of his time around tables. But the other thing that becomes clear when you look at all of these moments recorded for us of Jesus at basically dinner parties, you'll see that tables for Jesus were a whole lot more than just flat surfaces to eat and drink off of. There's something about that setting. There's something about a meal around a table that was something that Jesus gravitated toward as his favorite place of ministry. It was around tables over and over and over again that we see Jesus helping people understand who he is and what he came here to do and what it means to follow him, and that's really what the essence of this series is about. So what we've been doing all year from the first Sunday in January until today, we've just been looking at these different moments in Jesus' life that took place around a table, looking at what he said, looking at what he did, so that we might better understand who he is and what it means to follow him. And so this morning, to conclude this series, we are going to be looking at what I am absolutely convinced was the most memorable dinner party that the disciples ever had. In Luke chapter 24, it says, "On the first day of the week, very early in the morning, they came to the tomb, bringing the spices they had prepared. They found the stone rolled away from the tomb. They went in but did not find the body of the Lord Jesus. While they were perplexed about this, suddenly two men stood by them in dazzling clothes. So the women were terrified and bowed down to the ground. 'Why are you looking for the living among the dead?' asked the men. 'He's not here, but he has been resurrected. Remember how he spoke to you when he was still in Galilee, saying, "The Son of Man must be betrayed into the hands of sinful men, be crucified, and rise on the third day." And they remembered his words. Verse 13, "Now that same day, two of them were on their way to a village called Emmaus, which was about 7 miles from Jerusalem. Together they were discussing everything that had taken place, and while they were discussing and arguing, Jesus himself came near and began to walk along with them, but they were prevented from recognizing him." Verse 28, "They came near the village where they were going, and he gave the impression that he was going farther, but they urged him, 'Stay with us, because it's almost evening, and now the day's almost over.' So Jesus went in to stay with them. It was as he reclined at the table with them that he took the bread, blessed and broke it, and gave it to them. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, but he disappeared from their sight." Verse 36, "And as they were saying these things, he himself stood among them. He said to them, 'Peace to you.' But they were startled and terrified and thought they were seeing a ghost. 'Why are you troubled?' Jesus asked them. 'And why do doubts arise in your hearts? Look at my hands and my feet, that it is I myself. Touch me and see, because a ghost does not have flesh and bones as you see I have.' Having said this, he showed them his hands and feet. But while they still were amazed and unbelieving because of their joy, he asked them, 'Do you have anything here to eat?' So they gave him a piece of a broiled fish, and he took it and ate in their presence." Then finally, verse 46, "Jesus also said to them, 'This is what is written: the Messiah would suffer and rise from the dead the third day, and repentance for forgiveness of sins would be proclaimed in his name to all the nations, beginning at Jerusalem. You are witnesses of these things. And look, I am sending you what my Father promised. As for you, stay in the city until you are empowered from on high.'" This is God's word. What I just read to you, obviously, is Luke's account of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. The resurrection is not only the most important event in Christianity, I'd offer to you it's the most important event in human history. And I hope in about 25 minutes to make that case. When people in our increasingly secular and skeptical culture hear a story like the one that I just read to you, there's two questions that you have to deal with, that maybe I wouldn't have to deal with if I was preaching just several decades ago, but I have to do it now. The first question is, did the resurrection of Jesus really happen? Is it reasonable to believe that this literally, physically, historically happened? And the second question right alongside that is, if it did happen, then what does it really mean? The first question deals primarily with the mind. The second question deals primarily with the heart. And in order for the resurrection of Jesus Christ to make any difference in our lives, both of those things have to be engaged. So that's what we're going to do this morning. I'm going to talk about the resurrection of Jesus Christ and try to do the best of my ability to apply it to your mind and to your heart. But what I want to do to begin our time together is give you three reasons that it is very difficult to dismiss the fact that Jesus Christ was literally, physically, and historically raised from the dead. Three reasons that you actually can't explain the rise of Christianity apart from the resurrected Jesus. Here's the first one. Number one, the timing is too early. One of the most common objections to Christianity in our culture has to do with the timing of the writing of the accounts of Jesus' life. So a lot of people, particularly if you listen to debates like I do, I'm interested in those things, I like to hear the arguments against Christianity. And most often in debates, when people are kind of challenging Christianity, you'll hear something along these lines. If somebody's asked who Jesus is, they'll say something like, Jesus was obviously, he was a good man, he was an inspiring historical figure, but over time, his followers embellished about his life. And over centuries of the legends evolving and kind of mythologizing and people adding miraculous details to his life, it sort of evolved and all of those accounts got compiled. They became what Christians call the New Testament, and that's how you explain Christianity. That explanation for Christianity is basically an amalgam of what you're going to hear in Religion 101, Philosophy 101, and the Da Vinci Code kind of all wrapped together. The only problem with that explanation for Christianity is that every single facet of it is categorically false. So to begin, the New Testament accounts that record the life of Jesus, written primarily by Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Paul, these accounts were not written centuries after the events they describe. This might surprise you, but Luke's gospel account, for instance, which we spent the last 16 weeks in, Luke wrote his account only 30 years after the events that he describes. In other words, within the lifetimes of the witnesses that he mentions is in his account by name. And Paul the Apostle, the most prominent New Testament author, actually wrote within just 15 years. And on one occasion, recorded for us in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, Paul actually says that not only did Jesus Christ rise from the dead and appear to people, he says on one occasion Jesus Christ appeared to over 500 people at one time, and he goes even further than this, and he says, and most of those 500 people are still alive. You don't have to take my word for it. Go and talk to them if you don't believe me. Now, I don't have to tell you, that's an insane thing for Paul to say if he knew that he was making this whole thing up. Because if those 500 eyewitnesses of the resurrection don't immediately corroborate his claim, then just like that, Christianity dies before it gets off the ground. And yet, here we are 2,000 years later, still talking about it. So the first reason that it's reasonable to believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ is, number one, the timing is too early. Secondly, and I told the 9 a.m., I chose to lay these arguments out in order of how persuasive I think they are, starting with the least. So this argument, I think, is even more persuasive than the first. Number two, it's that the content is too counterproductive. So again, a lot of people in our culture might say something like, okay, I'll give you that the accounts were written pretty close to the events they describe, but people back then were gullible. They believe anything that you told them, which is the only reason that Christianity got any traction in the ancient world. With that idea in mind, let's read into the account, verses 36 through 38. Here's what Luke tells us. It says, and as they were saying these things, that's the disciples, as the disciples were saying these things, Jesus himself stood among them. He said to them, peace to you. But they were startled and terrified and thought they were seeing a ghost. Why are you troubled? Jesus asked them, and I think this particular question is interesting. Jesus said, and why do doubts arise in your hearts? Now, if you keep reading, Luke makes it plain that Jesus essentially had to prove to his disciples over and over and over again that he was real, that he had really been resurrected. And that's one of the details of the resurrection that every single New Testament author includes. You'll find that in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John's account of the resurrection, that the disciples did not immediately believe. You'll never find the disciples seeing the resurrected Jesus and saying, I knew it. My faith never wavered for a moment. Jesus instead had to overcome their doubts over and over and over again. Here's why this is important. Modern people have this tendency to think we don't believe in miracles anymore because we have a scientific understanding of the world. We know better. But ancient people were basically, they were gullible. They had a pre-scientific understanding of the world, so they'd believe anything that you told them. And obviously, it's true. Ancient people were far more likely to believe in miracles than modern people are. But one of the things that we have to keep in mind when we read these accounts is that all of the first followers of Jesus were first century Jewish people. And I want to offer to you, nobody listening to me right now would have a harder time believing in the resurrection than a first century Jewish person. Right? In Jesus' day, while most Jews, not all, but while most Jews did believe in some kind of end of history event in which there would be the resurrection of righteous people, here's what absolutely nobody in Jesus' day believed. This is why these disciples had doubts. What none of them believed is that one person could just get their resurrected body in the middle of history and start walking around appearing to people because they were God. Right? The idea that a human being could be God was not only unbelievable to Jewish people, it was deeply offensive to them. That's why if you follow Jesus' life to the end, you'll find it was his claim to be divine that actually sealed the deal on his execution. It was during the midnight trial, the religious leaders were trying to charge Jesus with something worthy of execution, and they finally asked him, "Are you the Son of God? Are you God's Son?" And it was when Jesus answered that question in the affirmative, Scripture says they tore their robes, they cried blasphemy, the trial was over because they had heard enough for Jesus' life to be forfeit. It wasn't just unbelievable to them, it was deeply offensive to them that a human being would claim to be divine. Here's where I'm going with this. If you were going to make up a religion with which to mislead first century Jewish people, you would never come up with something that sounds like Christianity, that sounds like a dead Jewish carpenter came back to life because he was God. You wouldn't even try to sell that story to them because they'd be the last people on planet Earth to believe it. And yet, something happened that overcame all of their doubts and got them to build their lives on this message despite how much it cost them to do so. And this actually brings me to my last and what I consider to be the most compelling reason to believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. It's lastly, number three, that the transformation was too radical. And here's what I mean. Look at verses 46 through 49. It says, Jesus also said to them, "This is what is written, the Messiah would suffer and rise from the dead the third day, and repentance for forgiveness of sins would be proclaimed in his name to all the nations, beginning at Jerusalem. You are witnesses of these things. And look, I am sending you what my Father promised. As for you, stay in the city until you are empowered from on high." Now let me just make sure we understand exactly what's recorded in those verses. Jesus is looking at his disciples and he's saying, I'm going to empower you all to go and change the world with the message that a dead Jewish carpenter came back to life because he was God. So just so we're clear, let's think for a moment here about who Jesus is giving this task to. This is something that Christians sometimes call the Great Commission. Jesus is giving this task to go and change the world to this ragtag group of 11 disciples who, keep in mind, it used to be 12. One of them betrayed him, that's Judas. One of them denied even knowing him, that's Peter, but the other 10 don't get a pass. Every single one of them abandoned him in his greatest hour of need. The fact that Jesus is trusting them with anything is wild to me, let alone a task of this magnitude. But here's what I think is even more wild. They got the job done. Now follow me here, because what I'm about to share with you is if you think like me, you'll agree, but this is what I consider to be the single most compelling reason to believe in the literal, physical, historical resurrection of Jesus Christ. Here goes. This is me throwing the kitchen sink at you. There were, in and around Israel, there were plenty of messianic movements, before and after Jesus' life, and there have been countless messianic movements throughout human history. So what do I mean when I say a messianic movement? This is important. A messianic movement is a movement in which the leader claims to be God, not just a prophet of God, not somebody that tells you what you need to do to be made right with God, but the leader says, I am God. I'm the author of your salvation. I can save you. Put your hope in me. What that means is Islam really can't be considered a messianic movement because Muhammad never claimed to save anybody. He was just a mouthpiece, he claimed, of God. Same thing with Buddha. Buddha never said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. He said, I know the way. I can point you to the way. It's the eightfold path, but you have to walk it if you want to find enlightenment, if you want to become one with the all soul of the universe. A messianic movement goes a step further in which the leader says, I'm not here to tell you about salvation. I'm here to offer it to you. I'm not here to help you connect with God. I'm God, and I'm offering to connect with you. That's a messianic movement. As I said, there have been countless messianic movements throughout history, and every single one of them has four marked and identifiable phases. Just at the risk of being too on the nose here, follow me here. Every messianic movement in human history has had four identifiable phases. I'm going to walk you through them right now. Here's the first phase of every messianic movement. The leader claims to be divine. Second phase of every messianic movement, some number of people believe the leader's claim. Might be a handful, might be a dozen, might be millions, but some number of people believe the leader's claim. The third phase of every messianic movement in history, the leader dies. And because dead people all tend to do the same thing, which is stay dead, here's the fourth and final phase of every messianic movement in human history, the movement dies. Let me give you a clear-cut modern-day example of this. Not too long ago, I was listening to a debate between Sam Harris, a famous atheist, and William Lane Craig, the famous Christian apologist. It was in April of 2011. They were debating at the University of Notre Dame. And the clip that I saw from the debate was during Sam Harris's time at the podium, and he referenced a religious figure named Satya Sai Baba. I just want to pause here. I never do this, but I'm going to do it today. By show of hands, would you please raise your hand if you know who Satya Sai Baba is? Okay. Between both services, I got three people. And that's actually more than I thought. I thought I was going to have a single person at both services. So if you listen to the debate, here Sam Harris explains who he is. For those of you, obviously most of you, who don't know. Satya Sai Baba was a religious figure that came out of India. At the height of his popularity, millions of people believed him to be a living God. And Sam Harris makes the case during his time at the podium that it wasn't just a phenomenon that was localized to India. He says every year, thousands of people from Western educated countries would hop on a plane to meet personally with Satya Sai Baba, and they would come away personally claiming that he had performed a miracle for them. You can go to his Wikipedia page and you'll find, again, at the height of his popularity, this is the gravitational pull that this historical figure had, the CIA, you can Google this when you go home, the CIA was legitimately concerned that another worldwide religion was going to flow from this individual. So Sam Harris references him and he says, listen, all the stuff that people say about Jesus, they say about Satya Sai Baba. Every miracle that the gospel accounts claims Jesus performed, including raising somebody from the dead, he says people claim that Satya Sai Baba has done something like that. So he holds him up as a messianic figure, and he says there's no reason to pay any more attention to Jesus than we do to somebody like Satya Sai Baba, because all throughout human history, we see over and over again these messianic figures. They appear, they have a following, they die, they go away. On its face, it's a fairly compelling argument, and it gains a lot of traction with people. But here's what I find so interesting. Nearly 2 weeks exactly after they debated in April of 2011, they debated it at the beginning of April 2011, almost exactly 2 weeks later, the date is April 24th, 2011, Satya Sai Baba died, I think at the age of 86 years old. And I'll just ask you, what do you think happened to his movement after he died? I bet you can guess. It died. Here's what we have not seen since April of 2011. We have not seen this explosive uptick in disciples of Satya Sai Baba who are dying rather than denying that Satya Sai Baba is Lord. That's not the way that messianic movements go. Because when you cross over that line and you get people to put their hope, not in your teaching, but in your person, when you make the claim that you are God, that you are the one that the world's been waiting for, you're the one that's going to fix everything, and people need to put their trust and put their hope in you, when you cross that line, then if you die, your movement dies with you. It can't survive without you. That's the way that every single messianic movement has gone in human history. There's exactly one exception to that rule, and it's called Christianity. When we look at the historical figure of Jesus Christ, we see something that we had never seen before Jesus and have not seen since Jesus. What we're seeing is a messianic movement that not only survived the death of its founder, but it exploded after the death of its founder, as hundreds and very quickly thousands of Jews and Greeks believed this crazy sounding idea that a dead Jewish carpenter came back to life because he was God, to the point that in the year 380, the Roman Emperor Theodosius declared Christianity the official belief system of the Roman Empire. So let me put a bow on this before we move on. You can say, as people did in Jesus' day, and some people do today, you can say, I don't believe the tomb was empty at all. But it would have been impossible for Paul, writing just 15 years after the crucifixion, to say that Jesus was alive and well and appeared to over 500 people if there was a decaying body in the tomb. That's the first place that people would have checked. And if there was a body in there, then Christianity would have died before it got off the ground. We never would have even heard the name of Jesus. He would have been forgotten, as countless other messianic figures throughout human history have been forgotten. Secondly, you can say, as people did in Jesus' day and so many still do today, okay, fine, the tomb was empty because it's a hoax. The disciples stole the body, they hid it, they buried it, and they made the whole thing up. Yes, you can go down that road, but if you go down that road, then here's what you're also believing. You're believing that hundreds of liars then went on to live these lives of compassion and courage and sacrificial love that literally changed the world, the vast majority of them choosing voluntarily to be disenfranchised, tortured, and murdered for what they knew was a lie. See, if there was some kind of social benefit to being a follower of Jesus for the first several hundred years of Christianity, I could believe that it's a hoax. If it was a power play that made them rich and famous and influential, then okay, I could believe that maybe they would make something like this up. But for the first several hundred years of Christianity, to dare to claim to be a follower of Jesus was to sign up for a creatively horrific way to be murdered in an arena before a crowd of thousands that applauded your death. You're telling me that men and women signed up for that, knowing that they were lying the whole time? I'm sorry, I don't find that compelling. And thirdly and lastly, you can say, no, it wasn't a deliberate hoax by the disciples. It wasn't malicious. It was a sincere delusion. They were so grief-stricken at the loss of their Messiah that they talked themselves into believing that he came back from the dead. And again, if that's where you land, it just shows, no offense, you know very little about how first century Jewish people think, because they'd be the last people on earth to believe a message like this. And yet, here's what we've seen. Yet something happened that was powerful enough, something happened that was convincing enough to blow away all their doubts and get them to dedicate their lives to this message despite how much it cost them. And here we are today, 2,000 years later, across the Atlantic Ocean, in a part of the world that Luke didn't even know existed, and every year, billions of people are still celebrating the birth, the death, and the resurrection of this one Jewish rabbi who made a claim that no other founder of any other major religion dared to claim, which is not just that he came here to help you find God, but that he was God, and he came all this way to find you. So everything I've said up to this point, I've said to simply make one simple statement. You do not need to check your intellect at the door in order to believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. There are really good reasons to believe that it really did happen. But as I said on the front end of our time together, it's not enough to simply believe in the resurrection like a naked historical fact. The question all of this demands, the question it demanded for the disciples that day, is if the resurrection happened, and of course I believe that it did, then what does it actually mean? And the answer to that question is going to be our next, and it'll be our final idea during our time together. Here's what I want to offer to you. It's that the resurrection can completely transform your life. That's it. I want to walk through what this means, what I mean by this, and then we'll conclude with baptisms. If you follow the lives of the disciples, not Jesus himself, but just the disciples, if you follow the way they are depicted through the gospel accounts, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, you'll find that despite the fact that they spent every day of their lives with Jesus for over 3 years, they are remarkably relatable people. The gospel writers over and over again show the disciples of Jesus this dream team that somehow changed the world, to be filled with all the stuff that our hearts are filled with. Over and over, we see him filled with fear and selfishness, narrow-mindedness, cynicism, hopelessness, even cowardice. But after the resurrection of Jesus Christ, what we see is that same group of people now suddenly known for their courage and their compassion and their bravery and a self-sacrificial love that caused them to gladly lay their lives down for a cause bigger than themselves that literally transformed the landscape of culture in the Western world and beyond. It's spreading like wildfire today in places like China and Africa. The question is, how is that possible? None of these followers of Jesus were known for that before the resurrection. All of them were known for it after the resurrection, and so were countless other men and women. How do you explain that? It's because the resurrection of Jesus Christ, when rightly understood, has the power to completely transform your life. To understand how it works, we just have to take a moment or two to compare it to some of the alternatives. Prior to Christianity, all ancient cultures, you can look at the other creation accounts, all ancient cultures believed that human history was cyclical, meaning this doesn't have a point. This doesn't have a finale. There's no grand design. We're not going anywhere. If you look at other creation accounts, they basically talk about mankind's creation as an accidental byproduct of a war between the gods, and so we're here by accident, and we're going to be here until we're just not here anymore, and that'll be the end of the story. What's fascinating is that kind of that same idea is almost exactly what modern secularism teaches. Now, to explain what I mean, I'm going to read a quote to you. I usually break this out every Easter. This is from Bertrand Russell, who is a famous 20th century secular philosopher. And this quote, it succinctly captures the essence of the belief system known as secularism. Here's what he said. He said that man is the product of causes that had no prevision of the end they were achieving. That his origin, growth, hopes, fears, loves, and beliefs are but the outcome of accidental collocations of atoms. That all the labors of the ages, all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system, and that the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruins. Here's how he ends it. He says, only within the scaffolding of these truths, only on the firm foundation of unyielding despair, can the soul's habitation henceforth be safely built. I told the 9 a.m., doesn't that make you want to carpe some diem? That quote perfectly captures the secular understanding of human history in general, but also of you and my life personally. The basic idea there is that you and I come from meaninglessness. We're not here on purpose. We're the unplanned pregnancy of the universe. We're in accidental collocations of atoms that just happen to form, and we'll be here till we're not. We came from meaninglessness. We're headed towards meaninglessness. And so ultimately, you're a coward if you can't admit that you're in my life in the grand scheme is meaningless, and this is all we get. And it's only on that foundation of, Bertrand Russell says, unyielding despair that we can build any kind of life for ourselves. So within that understanding of reality, within that worldview, let me ask you a question. And here's probably where this teaching is going to transition from more theoretical to a little bit more personal. Let me ask you something. Why is loss? We're all acquainted with it. We've all experienced our fair share of it. Why is loss so painful? We all know that it's painful, but why? Why is it painful when we lose somebody we love, like a number of us have? Why is it painful when we wake up sometime around midlife and realize my life isn't going to go the way that I thought it was going to go, and I'm not going to have that future that I planned for myself? Why is it painful when we lose opportunities, when we lose hopes, when we lose dreams? Why is it painful as we age when our body begins to break down, we lose agency, we start to lose our health? And we know it's not coming back. Why is loss so painful for us? Here's the answer I'd offer you to that question. It's because of this fear the human heart has that has a very tight grip on us. It's this fear we have under every other fear that this life is all we get. And within that understanding of reality, of course, that's going to create things like fear, like cynicism, like callousness and hopelessness and unyielding despair and selfishness and cowardice and all the things that we see in the disciples of Jesus prior to the resurrection of Jesus. Of course, that worldview is going to create those kinds of things in the human heart. Why wouldn't they? But I say all this to say the resurrection of Jesus Christ looks every single one of us dead in the eye, and it says, this is not all you get. This life is not all there is. And in the resurrection, Jesus is personally offering. This is what changed the disciples' lives. Jesus is personally offering all of us something that you will not find in any other belief system, religion, philosophy, or worldview. Jesus is offering us in the resurrection not just a consolation for the life that we lost. He's offering us a restoration of the life that we've always wanted but never been able to find down here. That I told the 9 a.m., I was born and raised in this. My uncle is the founding pastor of this church. My father pastored for a number of years. I was first through 12th grade Christian private school. I have heard more sermons. I've forgotten more sermons than most people are going to hear in their lifetime. I mean that sincerely. And so I don't remember a time in my life when I hadn't heard this story and at least mentally given assent to this story. But I'll tell you, even as a pastor, it wasn't until fairly recently, and maybe this will surprise you to hear, wasn't it until fairly recently that I understood exactly what's being offered to us in the resurrection of Jesus? Until fairly recently, I thought basically the story Christianity's telling us is that this life is broken by sin, it's full of disappointment, and you're going to experience a lot more losses than wins. We all know that if we've been around the block a few times. But you give your life to Jesus, and life will still be pretty hard, but after this, God's going to take you to heaven. And we don't know what heaven's going to be like. It'll probably be pretty bright, and there's clouds and maybe some gold and some harps. Whatever the Bible says about it, it's supposedly a pretty nice place that's going to make up for how bad it was here. I want to tell you, all that is, that's just a consolation for the life that you've lost. You can look at a number of other worldviews, religions, beliefs, philosophies, and they talk about the afterlife like that, like it's just a consolation for the life that you've lost. That's how I thought until I got my hands on a book called Hope in Times of Fear, written by Tim Keller. I read this book on the front end of COVID when he was newly diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer, and he knew he was not long for this world. In the book, Hope in Times of Fear, which I'd recommend to anybody, it's exclusively about the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And he says this one statement almost in passing that completely changed the way that I thought about everything that we're talking about today. He said that the resurrection of Jesus Christ, follow me here, the resurrection is not just hope for the future. He said it's more than that. The resurrection of Jesus Christ is a hope that comes from the future. That means that in the resurrection, God's power that will one day heal all of creation has broken into human history. This is what the New Testament author Paul is trying to get us to understand when he talks about Jesus as a first fruit or the firstborn of the dead. It means that when those disciples looked at Jesus, when those disciples looked at Jesus almost 2,000 years ago on that first Easter Sunday, they were looking at a glimpse of the restorative power of God that would one day not only heal all of creation, but would heal you and I. What this means is the story that Christianity is telling us is not that one day God's going to take us out of this big bad world and bring us to heaven. It's more than that. It's far more than that. The story Christianity is telling us, the promise that God is offering us, is that one day he's going to bring heaven to us. He will resurrect and restore this world to what it was always meant to be. And in Jesus, by grace through faith in his name, he will resurrect and he will restore you to what you were always made to be. That means that in the resurrection, you're going to get your life back, not your old life, but the life you've always wanted but never been able to find down here. You're going to get your body back, not your old body, but the one you always wanted but never had. You're going to get this whole world back, renewed and perfect, and no one and nothing can take that away from you. That means in the resurrection of Jesus Christ, no one finally misses out on anything. That's the story of Christianity. And the literal, physical, historical resurrection of Jesus Christ is the tangible evidence that that story is true and that the promises of God can be trusted. So we have just about arrived at the end of our time together. I know we got a lot of moving parts between the worship team, the baptism, and a whole mess of kids that are going to be in here. So with that, here's your cue, everybody. You can start moving. I'm going to try to land this plane. I started reading the genre of literature known as high fantasy back in the summer of 2020. And of course, we all remember what was going on in the summer of 2020. COVID had just hit. And at that point, nobody really knew how it was going to play out, but everything seemed so heavy, and it seemed so hopeless and so uncertain, and everything was so negative that I knew the most important thing that I could do is start filling my mind with stories that would give me hope. So that was the first time in my life that I read the Chronicles of Narnia. After that, I read The Hobbit. And then, of course, I came to Tolkien's classic trilogy, The Lord of the Rings. And before I cracked the binding on the first book in that trilogy, a friend of mine, a great friend of mine, he texted me and he told me that there's a monologue. It's not much longer than a page, buried almost right in the middle of that trilogy. He said that one monologue is worth reading the entire trilogy. He wouldn't tell me exactly what it was, but he told me to text him when I thought I found it. And as soon as I began reading it, I knew I was where he talked about. It's this moment where Sam is talking to Frodo, and everything seems so dark, and everything seems so hopeless. And it just seemed like there was no way out of this mess. And even if they somehow got to the other side, it could never be good enough to outweigh how bad it had been. Here's what Sam said to Frodo. He said, "It's like in the great stories, Mr. Frodo. The ones that really mattered. Full of darkness and danger they were. And sometimes you didn't want to know the end. Because how could the end be happy? How could the world go back to the way it was when so much bad had happened? But in the end, it's only a passing thing, this shadow. Even darkness must pass. A new day will come. And when the sun shines, it'll shine out the clear." That's the hope that we have in Jesus, church. It's that all this darkness and all this pain and all this suffering that sin has caused since that fateful day in Genesis chapter 3, in the end, we're going to see it's just a passing shadow. And when Jesus returns to finish what he started, the dawn that we've been waiting for since that day, that dawn will arrive. And when the sun shines, it'll shine out the clearer. Because in Jesus, all the great stories come true, and we will live to see this world set right. That's the hope we have in the resurrection. When you understand that hope and you make that the foundation of your life, it completely transforms your life. That's what it did for people 2,000 years ago, and it's what it's still doing for people today. So I'll leave you with this thought. I designed this message like I do every Easter. I designed this message specifically to appeal to your head and to your heart, and I've done that to the best of my ability. But I found in 12 years of doing this that you can argue with ideas. You can argue with teachings, you can argue with messages and propositions, but it's very difficult to argue with a transformed life. So if you're listening to me right now and you already believed in the resurrection of Jesus Christ, my hope is that you'd walk out of here with a little bit more of that peace and joy and hope that those first followers of Jesus had when they saw their perfected, resurrected Messiah and knew that their hope would never die because they had a living hope in Jesus. I hope you walk out of here with that same feeling that they had that first Easter Sunday. But if you've heard all this and you're still not sure what to believe, I'd simply ask you, as we transition to baptism, to pay very careful attention to the people who come forward publicly declaring their allegiance to Jesus. Because these people, through their baptism, they are the full and final evidence that Jesus Christ is alive and well. He's changed their lives. He's changed my life. And I promise you, if you trust him, he can change yours too. Happy Easter. That's it. That's all.